Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
I grew up in the church. My dad was a pastor in the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And when I say I grew up in the church, I mean that literally. We lived right next door to it. The sanctuary was my backyard. The fellowship hall, my playground. Some of my earliest memories are of running up and down the long carpeted halls of the seminary where my dad was studying to become a pastor. I'd chase echoes through old stairwells, past students poring over Greek texts, and occasionally sneak a donut from the coffee table outside the lecture halls. The church was our life. It shaped who I was, what I believed, and how I saw the world. Then I went to college in Columbus, Ohio, and like a lot of people, I was searching for community, for meaning, for something that felt real. That's when some of my friends invited me to check out Joshua House, a young adult ministry that was part of Vineyard Columbus. It was different than anything I'd experienced. Gone were the robes, the pipe organ, and the liturgy. This was a church in jeans and t-shirts, with loud guitars, laser lights, and pastors who looked more like TED Talk speakers than clergy. It was cool, and for a while, I was all in. Columbus is a major hub for the Vineyard movement. Vineyard Columbus, now based in Westerville, is one of the largest and most influential churches in the entire network. Years later, I met my now ex-wife outside of church. As we got to know each other, we realized we had both attended Joshua House during the same stretch of time, just never at the same moment. But for her, that period of time came with trauma. Shortly before we met, she told me about a night she had gone out drinking with friends from Joshua House. At the end of the night, she gave a male friend a ride home. He sexually assaulted her. And she did what so many survivors are told to do. She told her church leaders. But instead of walking with her to the police station, they told her she had made herself vulnerable by drinking. That what had happened was part of her, quote, sexual sin. That what she needed was soaking prayer. If you've never heard of soaking prayer, it's a practice where people, sometimes both men and women, lay hands on someone while worship music plays and prayers are spoken aloud. It's meant to bring healing, but in her case, it added another layer of violation. She attended a few of those sessions, then she stopped, and eventually, she stopped going to church altogether. Even after that, we ended up attending other Vineyard churches around Columbus over the years. Some of my best friends came from those churches. We shared meals, raised kids, and walked through life together. And I want to be clear, this series isn't a hit piece. I still care deeply about the people I met in those spaces. The pastors who tried, the volunteers who served, the friends who became like family. But it's precisely because of that, that I felt the need to ask hard questions. Because loving something doesn't mean excusing its failures. Sometimes it means telling the truth. A few years ago, my ex-wife was contacted by an organization called GRACE, Godly Response to Abuse in the Christian Environment. Vineyard had hired them to investigate a number of local abuse allegations. And so, she sat down with GRACE investigators and shared her story. For over 2 hours, she relived that painful night and everything that came after. They told her justice would come, or at the very least, counseling. But in the end, nothing happened. No accountability, no counseling, and eventually, Grace was dropped altogether. Vineyard brought in a new firm, Guidepost Solutions, to start a whole new investigation from scratch. And I couldn't help but wonder why. What was in the first report they didn't want to face? That question led me down a road I wasn't expecting, and what I found was more than one isolated case. I found a pattern of neglect, of protectionism, and of institutional failure. This series is the result of that search. We're going to look at three stories. The scandal that rocked Duluth Vineyard and raised questions about leadership and accountability at the national level. The abrupt takeover of Anaheim Vineyard, once John Wimber's church, by pastors who would eventually walk away from the movement entirely. And the quiet dismissal of pastors who simply asked if their churches could be fully affirming of LGBTQ people, and were told there was no room for that conversation. But before we get to all of that, we need to go back to the beginning. To understand what went wrong, we first need to understand what the Vineyard was supposed to be, and how a small, Spirit-led network of churches ended up in the business of empire building. The Vineyard didn't start as a brand. It didn't begin with metrics or conference stages or curated Instagram feeds. It started in living rooms, on beaches, in coffee shops and rented storefronts, among people who were hungry for something different. And to understand how it started, we need to talk about the Jesus movement. In the late 1960s and early 70s, a cultural shift was happening in America. The Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, Woodstock, Watergate. People were questioning everything, including the church. Out of that disillusionment came something unexpected. A spiritual awakening among hippies, dropouts, and burned out seekers. They started reading the Bible, talking about Jesus, and baptizing each other in the ocean. It was grassroots, raw, imperfect, but it was real, and it came to be known as the Jesus Movement. While traditional churches struggled to reach a new generation, these small communities flourished, often outside the walls of institutional religion. This was the soil the Vineyard was planted in. One of the early leaders in this new wave of Spirit-filled Christianity was a guy named Ken Gullickson. Ken was a gentle, unassuming former Foursquare pastor in Los Angeles who believed in a different kind of church, one built on relationship, not hierarchy, on spiritual gifts, not performance. In 1974, he started a small group that eventually became known as the Vineyard. It attracted artists, musicians, skeptics, and seekers. It was informal, charismatic, unpolished, but it spread fast. By the early 80s, there were a handful of Vineyard churches across Southern California. And then, in 1982, Ken handed the reins of the movement to a new leader, John Wimber. Wimber's story was different. He was a former rock musician, a founding member of the Righteous Brothers, believe it or not, who eventually left the music industry to follow what he called a spiritual tug. He later went on to teach a course at Fuller Theological Seminary on signs and wonders, training students in prayer, healing, and the gifts of the Holy Spirit. But Wimber wasn't just a charismatic teacher, he was a strategist. In the early 1980s, Wimber was leading a network of churches under the Calvary Chapel banner. But eventually, theological tensions emerged, particularly around the role of spiritual gifts. So in 1982, Wimber and his group of churches broke away and joined forces with Ken Gullickson's network. That merger marked the birth of what we now know as the Vineyard Movement. Wimber became its leader, its face, and, over time, its architect.
As I read the New Testament, I fell in love with Jesus. Didn't you? I liked him. I liked what he was like. I liked the things he did. I liked the things he said. Didn't you like those things? I thought that stuff was hot. I liked it when he multiplied the bread. Did you like that one? Huh? How about it? Do you like that? And the fishes, you know, the sardines. I always picture sardines. I like that stuff. I like all that stuff, you know? I liked it when he went by the fig tree and said, you know? And it died. Can you picture him doing that? I like all that stuff. I like it. I remember last night, come forth. That's a biggie, you know? I mean, that's hot. There are not many guys doing that come forth thing, you know, telling anybody to come up from the dead. I liked all that stuff. And when I became a Christian, I thought that's what I was going to do. I spent several weeks reading the New Testament and talking with these people, and I thought, this is great. You know, I'm going to join up. I want to do this stuff. And so I remember the frustration of attending church the first few times. You know what I thought they did at church? Now, this is how stupid I was. I thought that people gathered at the church, had a good time together, sort of divvied up the land, and everybody went out and healed a few and cast out a few demons and won a few people to Christ before lunch. And so the first few times I went to church, I went prepared with the idea that we're going to, you know, I'm going to take Anaheim. I want to go to Anaheim, you know, the deepest, darkest pagan Anaheim over there by Disneyland. That's where I want to go because that's where I was raised. And when they didn't do it, I was disappointed. And I remember one day asking a guy about it. I said, "Well, when do we go out and do it?" He said, "What?" I said, "When do we go out and do it?" He says, "Oh, you don't have to do it. You just have to believe it was done once." Now, that's pathetic. Isn't it? I found out over the next year or two that we cried about it. We sang about it. We preached about it. We prayed over it. We gave to it, but we never did it. We never got to go do the things that Jesus did. And I grew disillusioned in the process. Now, you know, when I worked for the devil, he let me do his stuff. Did he let you do his stuff? He let me do his stuff. But when I came to work for Jesus, they didn't want to let me do his stuff. And I, to tell you the truth, I joined up to do the stuff. Did you? You see, it's doing the stuff that's going to change the world. It's not knowing it was done once. It's not knowing that it's important. It's doing it that's going to change the world. Somewhere, someplace, somebody's got to start believing this book and acting on it. And I figure it might as well be us. We're qualified. We can read and write, most of us. And we understand that it can be done.
Wimber believed that church wasn't just about sermons or songs. It was about equipping ordinary people to do extraordinary things. Heal the sick. Cast out demons. Preach the good news. And under his leadership, Vineyard didn't just grow, it exploded. He introduced structure, branding, a leadership pipeline. And with that growth came something else. Momentum. Churches were being planted across the U.S., then internationally. Vineyard became a movement. And for a while, it still felt small. Still felt grassroots. But something was shifting.
But I do remember this shift of, like, one of the things that was such a key thing in my experience with the Vineyard was this dial down, no one's a rock star, no one is a, you know, we're not trying to platform people. We're trying to like, everybody gets to play. That was, like, one of the phrases that still gets used. But John Wimber, he wouldn't do the ministry from the front. He would, like, when it came to, like, time to lay hands on people, he would leave and have children come up and pray for people or anyone. So it was this idea of empowering everyone. And I remember slowly starting to feel a slight change from that, where there started to be people And maybe this is my perspective as a kid becoming an adult, but it started to feel like there was platforms where people were being kind of elevated because they were really gifted speakers or they were really gifted musicians or whatever it was. Like early days of the Vineyard, like you wouldn't have, I remember you wouldn't have like the names of the worship leaders on the covers of the albums. And because John Wimber was like, we're not trying to create rock stars. And I always, like for me, I really appreciated that. And so now slowly, and I don't know if it's at the fault of the national leader. I don't think it is. I think it's just kind of the evolution of how things happened in American Christianity. There's this thing of platforming gifted people and talented people. I do remember that. I remember Vineyard Columbus, which was where I grew up, went from a place where it was, you know, a couple hundred people to being a church of thousands. And in a church of thousands, you have to do things differently. And I remember those conversations overhearing my parents have and stuff about like, how do we keep that like energy of we are just a local church, we are a community of people, but also, you know, do a Sunday morning service for 10,000 people. So you started to see these platforms and these people starting to get elevated. But that would go, there'd be ebbs and flows of that.
That was former Vineyard pastor J.T. Meyer talking about how he started to notice platforming in the Vineyard. And that platform, it only got bigger in the 90s, thanks in large part to one thing, the music. Next, we'll look at how Vineyard's worship music took on a life of its own, spreading far beyond Vineyard churches and generating millions of dollars in revenue. Revenue that would be reinvested back into growth. And we'll start to ask a critical question. How does a small group of churches chasing authenticity become a brand chasing influence? If John Wimber was the visionary, Vineyard music became the vehicle. In the 1980s and 90s, the Vineyard wasn't just growing because of church plants or theology. It was growing because of worship. And not just any worship. Worship that sounded like something people actually wanted to sing. Raw, honest, repetitive in a good way. These weren't the hymns I grew up with. They were simple prayers put to melody. Songs that felt personal, experiential, sometimes even prophetic. And then came the moment it broke wide open. Vineyard Music began producing albums and distributing them. First through cassettes and CDs sold at churches, and later through major Christian bookstores and international licensing deals. Churches around the world, not just Vineyard churches, started singing their songs. Come, now is the time to worship. Refiner's Fire. More Love, More Power. Hungry, Falling on My Knees. Songs that showed up in Sunday set lists from California to Kenya. Vineyard wasn't just a movement anymore. It was a sound. You could walk into a church in a different country and still know you were in a Vineyard worship set. By the early 2000s, Vineyard Music had become a publishing powerhouse. And a financial one. Revenue from worship music helped fund church planning, pay national staff, and bolster the brand. According to publicly available data and historical reports, Vineyard Music was bringing in millions in revenue each year at its peak, through music sales, licensing, and global distribution. This wasn't just about spiritual expression, it was about scaling a movement. But when worship becomes a product, when authenticity becomes monetized, what does that do to the mission? Because while Vineyard's music was sincere, and many of its leaders well-intentioned, the infrastructure it helped build laid the foundation for a much larger shift. Suddenly, Vineyard wasn't just a group of churches. It was a brand. A brand with global reach, a sound, a style, a platform. And with that platform came pressure. Pressure to grow, pressure to scale, pressure to protect the brand at all costs.
We'd have to report at Duluth Vineyard, salvations, baptisms, small groups, new members. And we had to track everything because that is how you get attention in the vineyard. If you're not relevant, you're just another church. You're just someone else. You want to get into those conferences. You want to get into those rooms with Rich Nathan and Jay Pathak. And there's only one way to do it, is by getting attention, by being some sort of mover and shaker in the movement. And so it motivates you to honestly do insincere things.
That was Chris Sauter, former youth pastor at Duluth Vineyard. Coming up, we'll look at what happened next. The rise of metrics, the obsession with growth, and the slow shift from a spirit-led movement to an organization run more like a corporate empire. By the early 2000s, the Vineyard was no longer a loose network of churches. It had offices, a national leadership structure, quarterly updates, and, like many modern organizations, it had metrics. Lots of them. Every Vineyard church in the U.S. was asked to track and report key data points to the national office. We're talking number of weekend attendees, number of baptisms, salvations, small groups launched, volunteers engaged, leaders developed, churches planted. You can still find these reports online in Vineyard USA's annual stats. The idea was that metrics would help track health and tell the story of the movement. But what happens when those numbers become the story?
I am a fan of metrics, of measurables, in the sense that I think it's good for all of us to keep track of where we are in the story. What's the real picture? Like, there are a lot of times I think we can convince ourselves that things are one way when really, metrics tell a different version of that story. So I'm not against metrics per se, but for sure it has become necessary for us to report not just our attendance numbers, but we report on our attendance numbers. We report the breakdown of those attendance numbers demographically, men, women, children, racially, white, black, Asian, Native American, Hispanic. We are reporting on conversions and baptisms and decisions for Jesus, which all gets very convoluted, I think. We are reporting on, the mechanics, how many services we have, how many locations we have, giving information about our budgets, what kind of money we have. And those things have all, like, that's all evolved over the last 12 years since I've been here. It's just continually expanding. And I know some of the data that they try to gather is related to projects or initiatives for which they're trying to write grant proposals for. So I know that there's more to it than just collecting numbers. But it definitely also then leads to, hey, we didn't have enough conversion numbers. We had, a lot of our churches didn't really have any or very many conversions, so we're really gonna lean into evangelism this year, which is great, but the metric that wasn't really ever asked was, how much evangelism are you doing? It just assumes that if you're reaching out to people, if you're trying to make a difference in your community, that telling the story of Jesus, that you're going to have all these, people coming to faith in Jesus. And the reality is, depending on people's locations and their circumstances, they can be wildly faithful to the gospel, and they can be reaching out, and they can be doing all kinds of acts of mercy, and they can be telling people about Jesus all the time. But If they're in a, you know, predominantly churched community, or if they're inversely in a rural, very spread out community, and their church is, you know, struggling just to continue to meet, there are just so many factors that go into that. And
I work in the corporate world, and to be honest, this kind of thing looked familiar. We track key performance indicators, or KPIs, to understand performance. Sales, conversions, profit margins. But churches aren't supposed to be corporations. Or at least, they weren't meant to be. And yet, Vineyard was increasingly operating like a franchise model. Each church was locally governed, but under a national banner. And success was measured by output. The more you grew, the more platform you got, the more visible you became in the movement.
Like, churches aren't selling a product, like selling widgets. What we are, the data that we're choosing on are these incredibly sacred, nuanced things, right? Salvation is a beautiful, beautiful concept. But when you reduce it to a number to get some sort of gain, or to, like for me, Michael told me the only way I'm getting paid more is if I get new families in. And the way you get new families in is by like having this great product, and these kids would commit their life to Jesus, right? They'd get saved. And then they would go back home and bring their parents. And so I regret, but at the time I was really good at getting people to respond. And at the time I really believed in it. But in the back of my mind, I also knew if I don't get more people, I only get paid $25,000. I want to make more than $25,000. And so I was really good at creating those kind of places. And Michael was outstanding at it. He was so good at it. Like even when we'd have Easter and Christmas and every funeral, we had salvation packets that we put in the very back by the doors. And there was always a salvation call. And we'd say, on the way out, grab one of those salvation packets. It's going to help you take the next step, blah, blah, blah. And then anytime one of those, we count all of them because we knew how many were there originally. And then we'd report those as salvations. And so we kind of like padded the numbers pretty, pretty, pretty good.
But metrics weren't the only thing shaping the system. There was something else Vineyard leaned into heavily: married co-leadership. I did a random sampling of 40 Vineyard churches across the U.S. just to see, and out of those 40, more than half were led by married couples. And even in churches that weren't led by married couples, there were still often married couples in other leadership positions. Now on paper, that sounds like partnership, but in practice, it created massive conflicts of interest, because many of these churches also had church boards or elder teams theoretically designed to hold leadership accountable. But in far too many cases, the senior pastors were on the very board meant to oversee them. Sometimes both spouses were. Other churches didn't even have a formal board at all. And even fewer had established bylaws to dictate how discipline, review, or dismissal should work.
Yeah. And that's the whole, like, I mean, one of the things that's been so challenging is that we, you know, that in Vineyard USA on, you know, quote unquote, telling on themselves, you know, refers to this oppressive system that just kept their hands bound from being able to do these obviously right things. And that doesn't even exist. It never existed. There was nothing that prevented them from getting in a car or getting on a plane and going to that location and saying, hey, like, this is messed up. This is not how we're going to do things. This is inappropriate. Now, for sure, they had no like legal authority over them. They couldn't do anything if the Gatlins had said, well, screw you. We're going to do this the way we want to do it anyway. Well, sure. Okay, fair enough. But Brenda was employed by Vineyard USA. She was an employee of Vineyard USA, so they had employment power over her. Michael was a trustee of Vineyard USA, and so there was institutional power that they had over him. So they in fact had more authority over both of those actors in this situation than they generally do over
pastors of local churches. And they chose not to use any of that power to do the obviously right thing, in part because of which Rob says in one of the documents in the guidepost report, I think it's included in there, that, you know, he made some, you know, mistakes in judgment because of his relationship with Michael. And Jay says, you know, essentially the same kind of, seems to say the same kind of things, that there was, you know, this relational connection. And so maybe that wasn't, you know, he didn't always do the thing he would normally do. I know that when you love somebody, you want to believe in the best. I get that. But when you're a part of an institution, you have a responsibility. And that responsibility means that even the best of friends, even family members, you have to stop. You've got to recuse yourself from decision making. You've got to bring in people who are going to be objective and who can have the power to make the right decisions. And I don't know how a person becomes the national director of a movement like the Vineyard without having that straw of kind of basic common sense already there.
There's a phrase you'll hear a lot in this movement: local church autonomy. Vineyard has long claimed it isn't a denomination, that every church is self-governed. And that works, until it doesn't. Because when churches faced allegations of abuse or toxic leadership, national leaders often said, "That's a local issue, we don't intervene." But when those same churches wanted to become LGBTQ affirming or explore inclusive theology, suddenly, autonomy had a limit. Suddenly, there were rules, and if you broke them, you risked the nuclear option. Vineyard USA pulling your right to use the Vineyard name altogether. So what happens when a system rewards growth above all else? When the only guardrails are the people already in power? You get the perfect conditions for charismatic leaders to rise quickly without being questioned. Leaders who grow big churches, lead national ministries, and are almost impossible to challenge until it's far too late. Leaders like Michael and Brenda Gatlin. Next time, we'll begin their story. How they grew Duluth Vineyard into a powerhouse, how they rose to national prominence, and how a system designed to celebrate growth protected them at every step, even when the red flags were there all along.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again. Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.